Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/spoken today.
All right, we're back at it, Three Squares Live. Thank you so much for joining us on the 28th of October or on your favorite podcast platform, wherever you happen to be listening to us. Don't forget, we're doing these live now, so you have the opportunity to participate and send in questions or your comments in the chat function. Look forward to the ongoing engagement. I'm Charlie Arnott with the Center for Food Integrity and Look East, working to keep food trustworthy, and my colleagues, Susan Schwally and Kevin Ryan. Susan?
Hi, I'm Susan Schwally, food and beverage consumption at the NPD Group, where we transform our clients' businesses through deep consumer insights.
And I'm Kevin Ryan of Malachite Strategy and Research, helping CPG and retail companies do upfront innovation.
Excellent. So we've got three sections to Three Squares Live. We're going to talk a little bit about what's on the menu, something current, and then we've got a fantastic guest coming up. And then Kevin is back with What the Food? And he's going to give us another quiz. I thought I was going to be really slick today and have a really nice kind of diner bell, which you can now see for a sound effect for on the menu. But for whatever reason, the microphone doesn't pick up that frequency. So just imagine the dinging and what's on the menu. So we'll kind of pretend here that we've just been able to do that. And what's on the menu today is Kroger's acquisition of Albertsons and continued kind of restructuring of the food system and what that means. It's fascinating. I think it's just another illustration of what we're seeing in terms of the ongoing change as people look for opportunities to compete. Kevin, this is kind of in your space. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big question right now is it going to happen or not happen? I mean, from is the FTC going to put a stop to it or not? I mean, in my opinion, I think it will go through.
Yeah,
I think there's going to be some really interesting divestiture conversations. I mean, when Albertsons bought Safeway, what was that, 2012, 2013, something like that? Yep. They proactively divested to Hagen, and Hagen went bankrupt and sold it back to Albertsons. And so I think the FTC is going to put some real scrutiny on which divestitures. And I'm actually really curious to see who buys. And I think it'll probably be Amazon, actually. And so I think that's going to lead to some, I think if they're smart, they're going to take some of those West stores Coast. In the Midwest and West Coast, and they're going to buy them. I mean, I know tech right now is, kind of pinching the pennies a little bit, but I do think that that would be the smart long-term move. And usually Amazon does make long, smart moves. So I think
that's fascinating. That's what I'm looking for. About that. Yeah, that would be really interesting. Susan?
You know, it's interesting. I agree, Kevin. There's a lot of pushback right now on can the deal happen? Should it happen from antitrust? And from the consumer's perspective, there's a ton of concern about even greater price increases coming out of this. So, a lot of folks are thinking, well, it's going to be less competition. Prices are going to go up. There's talk about, is it going to create food deserts? They're both in about 34 to 35 states. So there's going to be overlap. I don't know if that's where it's going to go. Like clearly they're doing this for scale and to be able to compete with Walmart. And part of that is effective appealing pricing. But there's a lot of concern for the consumer around this deal. So it probably will get a lot of scrutiny and have some conditions placed upon it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think, personally, I don't think there's going to be much impact on consumers. I understand the concern anytime there's additional concentration, but retail grocery is still so competitive and low margin. I just think we're going to continue to see people look for other opportunities to increase scale, reduce SG&A, find everything they can do to continue to find other ways to increase profitability. But I think it will be interesting to see. I hadn't thought about Amazon, Kevin, but are there other regional players that could step in? Or does this trigger other regional players in terms of their conversation and discussion about additional mergers or acquisitions? Because it's either it's at either ends of the spectrum where people are going to be competitive. That mushy middle becomes even more conflicted.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say on the other side of this is, you know, you could, some people see it as, well, it's going to drive independent grocers out, the small guys. But on the other hand, does it potentially create more opportunity for them? Because people do want variety. Is it a greater opportunity for them to differentiate? And I mean, look, how we get our groceries and shopping is rapidly changing.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago. We didn't have Aldi or Trader Joe. Like, what's the next hybrid thing besides the behemoths that are going to be battling this out? So, I mean, look, we've been around long enough. We all know there's winners and losers in all of these things that happen, which means there's opportunity as well as, you know, some challenge spaces.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see. I mean, if the deal goes through, which I think it will, what Kroger is going to do, because they are just so innovative when it comes to, you know, their deal with Ocado, their deal with doing food trucks and all this kind of stuff. And then they have this scale being, will be the second biggest. How that will really change the market. I think it's going to be really interesting. I think they'll definitely give Walmart and Amazon a run for their money.
I was just reading about those, the Ocado powered self-checkout grocery carts. Now, Meijer, in my neck of the woods, M-E-I-J-E-R, Meijer, you can do that right now, shop and scan on a mobile app. It's not built inherent into the cart, but you can do all your shopping, scan while you shop, and then just walk up to a kiosk at the end and walk out. So it's interesting that they've built it into the cart structure. And to your point, I do think that's one thing that's interesting about them because, I mean, let's be clear, the shopping experience at Walmart is not a good one, at least in my point of view. And Kroger will offer a very different perspective on a very large level.
Right. Yeah, we've had this conversation before. I love self-checkout because it's a more expedient way to get in and out of the store, which is very appealing to me. So anything I could do to make that process more efficient, I'm all
in. I mean, maybe it is, but you're in control, so you feel it's more expedient.
True. Yeah.
It's all could about control Charlie. Issues.
It's all about control.
Not that we control anything, but no. it's the ability to feel like we do.
We like the illusion. We like the illusion.
Yeah.
All right, let's transition to our guest. So, Susan, you've been done a great job here of scoring an outstanding guest. If you'd like to introduce Locke, we'll kick this thing off.
I'm so excited. Yeah, Locke's going to join us here. Look, I have the pleasure of introducing Locke Hildebrand, who is the Chief Insights Officer for Wisdom, which is an insights agency out of Springfield, Missouri. And full disclosure, Locke and I are friends as well as colleagues, and we do some things together, MPD and Wisdom together. I'm going to let him talk a little bit more about what they do, but most simply, the magic that Wisdom creates is they develop custom audiences for direct outreach based on behavior and location. Now, anybody who's listened to the show knows that I'm all about consumer behavior, and Locke and his team do this in a very different way to help understand emerging things, generational things, and that's what we're going to talk about today. But Locke, let you have a word in edgewise. Say hello, and what else do you want our listeners to know about Wisdom?
Hello. You know, I think the most important thing is, you know, we were born out of the food world. We come from a 40-year food agency background that then transitioned into a 15-year behavior around consumers and food background. And then when big data came onto the scene, we said, how can we merge those together? So for us, it's about, you know, figuring out how to combine big data and consumer behavior because, you know, Susan, as we've always talked, I'm very much sort of a soft science advocate alongside of big data, you know, so for me, being able to merge the two of those together has always been super exciting.
Yep. You know, one of the things that we had a sidebar conversation on was about Gen Z. And I know you've got a lot of thoughts and you've been watching this group carefully. And I'm just wondering to kick us off, if you could, you know, it's so easy to say, oh, Gen Z, they're just the next iteration of the millennial. Could you talk a little bit about what you find truly differentiating about them and then like relate that to food and beverage?
Sure. You know, I think one of the most interesting differentiators for millennial to Gen Z is millennials grew up with legacy brands and being taught the power and the importance of a legacy brand. So the attitude has always been fitting those brands into their life in a sense where they were an extension of themselves. And it was a very branded identity. And Gen Z, having grown up with the full capabilities of the modern internet, they created their own celebrities, they created their own brands through social media. For them, it's always been around this idea that they look for brands that identify with parts of who they are, their moral code, their personal ethics, their personalities. So while millennials are very much sort of brand-centric, Gen Z is brand-centric in a sense that they only pick and choose ones that fit them personally. And it's a slight nuance, but at the same time, it's sort of a bigger picture idea of looking at it like, you know, millennials have always rolled with the punches as everything's happened as they've grown up, you know, and they've always strived for authenticity with food. And Gen Z is sort of this like, why not attitude? So everything is very playful. The day part rules are broken for them. They're just kind of doing whatever they want with food. And, you know, brands are trying to catch up to it.
Go ahead.
So a question that I have. So how are brands successfully connecting with Gen Z and who's doing it well? I guess kind of a follow-up on that. Is this a life stage or do you think this is kind of a you know, behavior and loyalty that we're going to see extend? I think it was Churchill who said, you know, if you're not liberal when you're young, you don't have a heart. And if you're not conservative when you're old, you don't have a brain. So,
Wow. Fitting Churchill in.
Yeah. Well, sorry.
Goals.
I'm the old guy. But you know, is this life stage? Who's connecting with them? Who's doing it well? And then is this transient or is it something that's going to stick?
You know, and I think that the thing that's scary about this is because Gen Z is evolving alongside of technology, having grown up with technology, is it's changing the food world for them, you know, drastically over time. I think what you have to look at as far as who's doing it well is you have to look at companies that are adopting that why not philosophy. Like, I think Taco Bell's a great example because they're just willing to wing it and innovate based off of that why not idea. They're like, hey, we're going to take a giant Cheez-It and we're going to call it a tostada because why not? You know, and it's sort of that mentality, which is scary for a lot of brands because it's like you're kind of innovating in the dark in some ways with them. You know, as far as a life stage goes, that's kind of hard to predict because Gen Z moves so quickly. You know, this is the group that has cycled through, you know, since 2010, like 12 different aesthetic styles, you know, that their whole life was centered around, and they just keep evolving it. And one of the things that I think has been really fascinating to look at and try to understand with them is, and this is going to be a bit of a in the weeds breakdown, is, you know, millennials, and the thing that everyone tried with millennial branding was about irony. That doesn't work with Gen Z because they can smell branding a mile away. So Gen Z has sort of taken to being like, oh, cringy things are funny. So we're going to make things cringy because they're funny. But then if a brand makes something cringy, it's actually cringy. So it's a very like hard thing to kind of process for brands to get into that mindset because it evolves and changes so fast.
Right. So Kevin, right, as an innovator, I mean, this is really interesting, but it's also got to be terrifying if you're trying to figure it out. Right. I mean, what do you do?
It's a good question.
I think one of the scary parts about that is, you know, if we look at what we learned and the lessons learned from millennial branding, is that brands went so heavy into millennials that they alienated every other generation. You know, some brands went so far in that by the time millennials were no longer a core consumer, it was like, who are we as a brand identity anymore? And I think that's the scary part, is that idea of trying to jump too far into Gen Z and then losing everyone else in the process simply because the language is so different, and trying to adopt Gen Z slang into branding is kind of very alienating for people who aren't, you know, technically like up with the Joneses on what it is. I feel old just saying that. You know, so.
Well, speaking of that, Locke. Okay, so I'll be controversial and I'll say, is Gen Z the new Gen X? And I say that because I'm Gen X, and we were forgotten about. And mm-hmm. Gen Z is the third largest cohort, depending on, I guess, how you measure it. But it's usually considered third largest behind Boomers and Millennials. So, you know, while they're currently in that sweet spot of like, you know, the 18 to 24, or they will be in the 18 to 24 side where everyone always seems to want to go, they're still the third largest. So my question is like, do you think that Gen Z will continue to be the one that people will go to target, or will they become the Gen X and like the lost generation?
So it's interesting that you bring that up because this is one of my favorite topics. There's a term that some Gen Zers have self-identified with called the new nobodies. Mm. And the idea behind it is that they grew up in a time when they were too young to be sold millennia nostalgia to understand it. but they were too old for all the stuff that was being marketed for kids. And that's why they became so sort of like self-involved with content creation and with, you know, sort of like that whole memes as their identity, is because they had to create a generational identity for themselves because they didn't feel like it was made for them. And, you know, as we're starting to look at trends, you know, across food and across beverage and starting to think about it, there is a high chance that because Gen Z has sort of made themselves so almost awkward to market to, that we're going to skip right over them and go to sort of like the child gatekeeper millennial parent and their Gen Alpha children.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the X's and the Z's, seeing that we are the least, you know, remembered of the alphabet, we need to get together. I think that's what it is.
You're going to have
a vowel in there somewhere, though. I mean, otherwise you're going to play Scrabble and it's not going to work. Alpha. Okay. Well, that'll be interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's also interesting because if you look at how both were raised, you know, millennials were raised in sort of that idea of like, here's the world, it's your oyster, go for it. By boomers, and Gen Zers were raised by Gen X. And it was sort of like, here's the world and here's how you need to fit into it. Mm-hmm. So there's a much more grounded sense of reality at a younger age that the world's not their oyster. They just have to find a way to adapt and move into it.
Yeah. So look, this sounds like a minefield to me, what you're describing in terms of marketing. How in the world do you even approach it? I mean, everything you've described makes me incredibly anxious and uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I think that's where a lot of brands are, is that there's a level of uncomfortability in how to try to talk to Gen Z, because you either go all in and you alienate people or they make fun of you because you're trying to, you know, do the hello, fellow kids sort of mentality. Mm. Or you ignore them and stick to, you know, like the traditional like Gen X, baby boomer and millennial sort of demographics. So it's a really hard thing, I think, for brands to navigate. And, you know, that's why, you know, if you look at how brands have attempted to with food, you know, they're putting out like influencer menus as LTOs rather than doing big pushes for food innovation. You know, and then you see all of the Gen Z celebrities starting to get in the food game, like Mr. Beast, you know, has the ghost restaurants, and now he has a candy bar. And so it's going to be interesting to see what happens, is all of these young entrepreneurial Gen Z influencers that have a lot of money and are looking at what they want to do with the rest of their lives are being pitted against traditional restaurant spaces and traditional grocers.
It's interesting. I spent an evening trying to track down a Mr. Beast Feast candy bar because my Gen Z 11-year-old wanted it, and Walmart supposedly carries it. Now, the tags were on the shelf for the facings, but they were completely empty. So they either weren't there or they were sold out. I also spent an evening on vacation ordering Mr. Beast burgers because we were in a city and we could do it. And all of the order was incorrect, but my child was so happy to try the Mr. Beast burger and loved it, because this is, you know, they don't watch Saturday morning cartoons. They watch YouTube and they're on social media. So I think that's really interesting, Locke, that these folks are going to be looking for different ways to parlay their influence. And food is like, I think, just a natural step for them.
You know, and social media, I think, is such an important thing for them because that's the world they grew up on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's no longer an opt-in for them. You know, like millennials were kind of like the digital nomads that jumped from place to place to place to place as it evolved. These guys have grown up with platforms set in, you know, since they were, you know, toddlers. And it's changed how they gain access to food, how they think about food ingredients. You know, like, look at a millennial versus a Gen Zer as far as social media and food influences. The millennial's looking at Instagram, looking at beautiful food. And the Gen Zer is like, I need to figure out how to make a snack in 3 minutes. I'm going to go to TikTok. I don't care what it looks like. I just need it to fulfill a purpose.
Yeah. What brands do you think are doing well when it comes to talking to Gen Z? I mean, beyond food and beverage, if that's necessary, like which ones do you think kind of get Gen Z, or is there?
I think it's sort of like a touch and go scenario because they're sort of like, it feels like everything that's done for Gen Z is done kind of like, and I hate to use this word because I feel so old, like drop culture, where it's like, oh, we're going to have a drop. And if you're unfamiliar with the term drop, it's basically like an LTO, you know, so we're going to do a drop of a collaboration between a high-end brand and a low-end brand, or, you know, like a lot of brands right now, I think are stepping either into food that aren't food involved, or are stepping out of food that are food involved and launching merchandise. And that is technically their outreach, is they're just kind of doing weird, zany things. Like, I think Hidden Valley does some interesting stuff. They do some really weird off-ball. I mean, they did like the ranch fountain, you know, to see if you get like a cheese fondue fountain, but ranch, you know. And then there's always the weird stuff like KFC doing, you know, chicken scented candles. I think the more interesting ones right now is brands that are being really willing to let kind of like Gen Z take control of the reins of their brand identities. I think that's been one of the most successful things, with like Pepsi at one point doing sort of like the print your own t-shirts based on, you know, uploading images, and just sort of like letting them play with the brand, which a lot of brands were so nervous to do with millennials. But I think that that's one of the things that it's taking right now, is to kind of like tread the fine line of how do you talk to and play with them and engage them, but not make them feel like they're being either talked down to or you're trying to fit into their club too much. Right. You know, and I think
that's giving them control.
Yeah. And that's real scary.
Mm-hmm.
Is that leading to profit though? I mean, like when Oreo dropped the Supreme connection, like you said, you know, they did the work with Supreme. I look at that and I said, that's really cool. And I like that. But at the end of the day, is growth and profit increasing, or is it really just a long-term bet for the future that they're going to have Oreo fans from this generation?
I think it's almost right now looking at a, hey, remember us, look who we can work with, you know, and that's why this is all so tricky, and why I think Gen Z is going to be such a hard market to really corral, really honestly, until you know, they're in their 30s. And they settle down and, you know, they're having to come up with solutions for them and their families rather than them just creating a solution for themselves. Because I think that whole time period is just kind of going to be a black hole of, let's create something to get it out there so that they remember that we're here.
Mm-hmm. So if you'd like, you've got a question for Locke, we've got about 2 minutes here left with him. So if you'd like to submit a question or a comment, now is the time. You'll never get free consultation again. So drop your question in if you're listening on live. And if you're listening to us on any podcast, remember to join us live next time, because that way you'll actually get to submit your question. It's hard for me to talk because my mouth is still watering from the ranch fountain. The concept of a ranch fountain is just really, really appealing. Maybe that's
not the Kentucky Fried Chicken scented candle?
Well, I think the combination. I mean, if you had the ranch fountain and you could dip the Kentucky Fried Chicken into the ranch fountain, now that would be nirvana.
Sensory overload.
I got a question here for you. So it sounds like there's a lot of experimentation, right? A lot of trial and error. How forgiving if you stumble, if you stub your toe here with Gen Z, are they willing to give you the benefit of the doubt and say, hey, thanks for trying, try again?
I think as long as it's not trying to like tap into them on a language side, and by that really what I mean is, like right now, a great example is, you know, the term sleigh is now being used for Christmas instead of S-L-A-Y, is S-L-E-I-G-H. I've seen probably 30 emails in 2 days that are already using it. And that's one of those like, ooh, don't use our words this way, you know, like it's just, so like, I think as long as it's a product with good intention, it's not going to be a mishap. It may not be as successful, but like it's really with them. It's like, don't try to act like us, try to participate with us.
So Taco Bell's breakfast apology. How would you rate that? Have you seen that?
With Pete Davidson?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen mixed, simply because there were a lot of people, like especially on Reddit and other places, that were like, I hate a 2-minute video of an ad of him eating in slow motion. So it was like sort of really off-putting. But then, you know, it's another one of those things where it's that thin line of it's a celebrity that they know, but at the same time, it's not one that they helped foster into existence. So it's kind of like 50-50, and people think that it more swings towards younger millennials than Gen Z.
Yeah. Yeah. This is fascinating. We could continue the conversation for a long time. This is, thanks for sharing your wisdom.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
a little brand drop there. So yeah, this was terrific. So thanks. And we'll be sure to catch up with you again. It's always a pleasure, and enjoy your next visit to Lambert's, and be careful, wear a face mask if you get hit with a throat roll. So
thank you, Locke.
Thanks, Locke.
Thank you.
Yep.
Appreciate it. All right. For those of you who are regulars, you know, it's now time for What the Food with our benevolent food scientist and resident child cookbook author and expert on all things food. So Kevin, hit us.
Our dimpled darling.
That's right. Oh, I like that one. We haven't used
that
one
before.
There
you go. Yeah.
And you said it's going to be a quiz again. People like the quiz, but you also promised no math.
They like it when you pit Charlie and I against each other. Yeah, no math.
It's the reason that I went into communications is because I didn't have to take math.
So. Right. Well, I thought this seemed very timely. I thought I was thinking about Halloween, and I was thinking Halloween is one of those holidays that doesn't have a food associated with it. Like Thanksgiving has foods, you know, it's like the green bean casserole.
Candy.
Well, yeah. What about candy?
Exactly.
Corn?
Candy. And so I thought, candy, okay, corn. What could we do with candy? But before I did that, I thought, oh, little quick history lesson. Do you know that the reason that we trick or treat is because there was an old Celtic tradition. Oh, it was called Samhain, which was like the belief, you know, the whole belief about Halloween that on that night is the closest we get to like the other side, that there's like this, the ghosts would. Well, they used to actually make these things called soul cakes. They're like cookies with dried fruit in them. And you would find, you would give them to poor people and with the promise that they would pray for your ancestors on that night. And then pretty soon what would happen is people would actually come to your door and ask for these and promise to pray. So what's interesting is that later turned into giving candy away. So I always thought that was interesting. But I thought a really cool quiz would be, I give you the origin story, really quick, one sentence origin story of the candy. Ooh. You tell me what candy it is.
Oh, yes. Okay.
All right. Okay. So there's some hard, I've got 10 of them that I'm not going to get through them all. So I thought maybe I'm going to start with some easy ones or easier ones. Okay.
All right. Warm us up.
Okay. This candy was given its name in 1923 after the company launched a naming contest. And it was a popular word at the time for that sportscasters used for meaning a clumsy person.
A clumsy person.
I was going to say Milky Way, but that's
No. Someone's clumsy. They drop something. Oh, I'm a
Butterfinger.
Got it. Okay. All right. This candy was first introduced in England in 1959, and it was originally called Opal Fruits. It's a horrible name.
Opal Fruits?
Opal Fruits. So it's a fruit-flavored candy.
Something berry. Gummy bears?
Gummy berry.
Is it something berry? Not berry.
No.
It has fruit in it?
Juicy fruit?
There shouldn't be fruit in candy.
Okay. Time's up. Starburst.
Oh, that doesn't have fruit in it. It was called Opal Fruits.
Opal Fruits, yes.
Yeah, Starburst.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
This candy should be fired.
Well, maybe they have been. This candy is named, supposedly, there's a couple of origins, but this chocolate candy is named after the sound the depositing machine makes when forming the candy.
Drop.
Clunk.
Dips, drop, clunk,
getting there.
Chunk.
Close.
Yes.
Yes. What did you say, Susan?
Kiss.
Yes. Hershey's Kisses.
Really?
Reportedly named after the sound it makes when it comes up. Yep. Yes.
All right, Charlie, we're tied.
All right.
I did not know that. That's fascinating.
All right.
Nor did I?
Okay. Invented in 1932, this candy originally consisted of three tiny bars, vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry, but wartime rationing eliminated all but the chocolate one.
Oh,
three tiny bars.
Twix? Is it Twix? No, it can't be Twix. It's not all
Tootsie Roll.
Three Musketeers. Three Musketeers.
Oh.
It was called Three Musketeers because it was chocolate, strawberry, and vanilla.
That makes so much more sense now.
I was thinking about Neapolitan or something. Yeah, the Three Musketeers.
Yeah.
Okay. Invented in 1974 in Britain. This candy is named after an ancient lawn bowling game, because the candy is said to resemble the game's pieces.
Something pins. Twiddly.
Close, yes.
Pins, sticks.
Pins? Heat.
This is a tough one. No. Oh,
it feels English.
Resembles the pins. Resembles the...
For lawn bowling?
For lawn bowling. It's an old lawn... I'm a really old lawn bowling game. Tick, tick, tick. Okay, Skittles.
That's round.
That's lawn bowling game. I think it either it's named for the pin, which apparently it is, but to me it looks like a ball. I agree.
Yeah, it does like a bocce ball. More like I think like if it was bocce, if it was Italy, we'd have gotten that one.
All right, time for one or two more.
That was very confusing.
No, that was
Named after a 17th century literary club, headed up by a man named Christopher Catling.
Heath.
No, Christopher Catling.
Kit Kat.
Kit Kat. It was called the Kit Kat Club.
How did we get literary to chocolate covered wafers? Was this their shtick? This is what they ate.
They met in the back of a pastry shop.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
Right. Last one. I could see that evolving from a pastry shop.
Okay, here we go.
Last one. This candy was originally called chicken feed.
What's that? Chick pop.
Nope.
I'm off the wrong one.
It's pretty old. And it's usually the most derided candy. Sorry.
Circus peanuts.
Close.
Oh, candy corn.
Candy corn. Because it looks like chicken feed.
I love candy corn.
Originally called chicken feed.
But it's one of those divisive candies. Either people love it or hate it. There's nobody on the fence with candy corn.
That's true. Everybody liked it.
Oh no.
The pumpkins are better.
Lewis Black has a famous thing where he just derided that there's no candy corn. Candy corn, no new candy corn has been made since like 1940.
That's kind of like fruitcakes, right? they just keep circulating.
I did not realize
some poor unsuspecting person, you give them the fruitcake that you had 6 years ago and it's still circulating.
Oh, exactly. Candy corn.
What was the final score? I don't even know. Did you guys keep track?
I'm pretty sure I won.
No. We'll go back. We were tied before the last one.
Yeah, do you need a tiebreaker?
That was the tiebreaker. That was the tiebreaker. Candy corn was the tiebreaker.
Yeah. Right. Oh, so wait, we're tied?
No. I won by one.
What were the three you got?
I got Three Musketeers. I got the candy corn. And then there was one before that, the very first one.
Butterfinger.
Yeah. I only had two?
Yeah, I got three.
You got Kisses and Kit Kat.
Yeah. I only get Hershey brands. That was the problem.
3-2.
That's it. Until next time.
Yeah, went back until after Halloween, but that's okay.
I won the diner thing either. I'm very competitive. This is a problem.
Well, we'll do it again next month. Hey, and next month, we're going to be a little bit earlier in the month because Thanksgiving is coming, and I'm thankful to be able to work with both of you and thankful to everybody for listening to Three Squares.
Yes.
Lisa Keefe will be with us on November 18th at 12 o'clock noon Central Time. Lisa is the executive editor, I think, of Meeting Place and Alt Meat as well. And we're going to be talking about what's gone on with Alt Meat because lots of different opinions about what's taken place with Alt Meat. Obviously, lots of interest in high initial sampling kind of dropped off, tremendous investments, some rationalization taking place. Is there a future? Is there not a future? What's going to happen with Alt Meat going forward? So join us for that on the 18th. We want to thank Locke Hildebrand again from Wisdom for joining us and bringing us some wisdom today. That was very exciting, and encourage you to participate. You can drop us a line if you'd like at threesquaresmail@gmail.com, the numeral threesquaresmail@gmail.com, or tune in on the 18th of November at noon. And once again, we'll see you next time on Three Squares. Susan, Kevin, thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Have a good weekend. Thank you. Happy Halloween.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.